You're listening to Two Bobs, Conversations on the Art of Creative Entrepreneurship with David C. Baker and Blair Enns.
Blair, are you ready to talk about all of your biases?
Oh, yeah. I actually love talking about my biases. I don't think we put our biases, I'm going to say the proper way, biases. I don't think we put our biases on the table often enough. Yeah. So I'm really excited about this.
You're a very biased person, I've noticed. And so we're not going to get to my biases today.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll lie on the couch today.
Okay. Yeah. This is really an intervention. A lot of the people close to you in your life have asked me to have a podcast where I interview on your biases. So just be prepared.
That explains the crowd outside the door.
Right. Yeah. So you thought about this topic, and let me get inside your head. What was it that made you think this will be interesting? What a loaded way to ask that question. What possibly possessed you? No. What made you think that this was really interesting? Because as I was starting to read more about it, because admittedly, you know so much more about this than I do, I was really interested in it too. But talk to me about how our listeners are going to be interested in this and why.
So the subject is really cognitive biases and other forms of biases. We're going to put them all under that banner of cognitive biases. Some of them are actually social biases. Behavioral economics is the new pop psychology. And I don't mean to kind of demean the, I won't call it science, although it's a social science. Let's call it a social science. I don't mean to demean it by referencing it as pop psychology. There's just so many books written on it. To me, advertising as a profession, and I spent a lot of years working in it, it just became so uninteresting for so long until people started applying some principles of behavioral economics to advertising. And that's when it became interesting again. So you've got people like Rory Sutherland, who's the vice chair of Ogilvy UK. He's probably at the forefront of bringing behavioral economics to the world of advertising. And now you see it everywhere. Robert Cialdini, the author of Persuasion and a few other books, and Presuasion is his latest. I haven't read that one yet. So there are all kinds of people out there bringing behavioral economics to advertising and the other creative professions. And you just see it everywhere in business. In my last book, Pricing Creativity, A Guide to Profit Beyond the Billable Hour, I had a chapter on essentially leveraging cognitive biases. So let's put the $10 word on the table, shall we?
Okay. Heuristics?
Yes. Is it heuristic or is it heuristic?
I don't know.
I usually split the difference on the H and I try to do a half of an H, heuristic.
Pretend to cough while you're saying it so that if somebody thinks you're not saying it right. Right. So heuristics. Okay.
Yeah. So a heuristic is essentially a mental shortcut. It's really a practical approach to solving a problem that employs mental shortcuts. So like a rule of thumb, educated guess, common sense. When people reference those things, they're really talking about heuristics. So heuristics are things that essentially allow us to reduce the cognitive load in decision-making. So we don't have to employ all of our brain power to answer some questions, because some questions are easily answered through these kind of mental shortcuts. And then sometimes the idea of kind of leveraging cognitive biases in decision-making in business, it's often known as choice architecture, how we kind of architect the choices that people end up making. And it sounds a little nefarious, doesn't it? The idea of choice architecture.
It does a little bit, right? Sounds a little manipulative. But in this, as you talk, we're going to go through a whole bunch of these, but as you talk about how you might recognize the shortcuts that prospects are making, you were going to suggest some ways that you could gently nudge, but stopping short of manipulation. But the other interesting thing as we talk through these is just to start to recognize how we are taking mental shortcuts, sometimes inappropriately. So it's going to be a little bit of self-examination as well as we go through these.
Yeah, and you used a really important word, a keyword, nudge, which I think it was Thaler, Richard Thaler, who coined the term. I'm holding his book right here, Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness, Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein. Cass Sunstein's a law professor at Harvard, or was up until recently. And then Thaler is known as the kind of one of the fathers of behavioral economics. So the idea of, you know, choice architecture and nudging goes hand in hand. If you look at it magnanimously, how do you nudge them to make a decision that's in their best interest? And if you look at it kind of nefariously, how do you nudge them to make a decision that's in your best interest? When I first wrote about this a couple of years ago, I wrote an article. You can find it on winwithoutpitching.com. It's called The Dark Arts of Leveraging Cognitive Biases. And I really like that title, The Dark Arts. But I got a bunch of blowback hate mail and accusations of condoning the manipulation of others. And when we get into some of these specific biases and how to leverage them, you'll see that we're never really without bias. We're already subject to our own biases. We're subject to the biases of others. And we intuitively sometimes tap into those biases when dealing with others. Now, I want to give you an example of a heuristic approach to problem solving. I'm going to give you a puzzle and I want you to give me the answer. If a baseball bat and a ball cost a total of $1.10, so a baseball bat and a ball cost $1.10, and the bat costs a dollar more than the ball, then how much does the ball cost?
Well, immediately I'm saying 10 cents, right?
Yeah.
But I think you probably just tried to embarrass me in front of tens of thousands of people, but yes, I'll play along. 10 cents.
Do you want to think about it more?
No.
So that's the first answer. We think, well, we just make this approximation. And so Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, talks about these two systems of thinking, system one and system two. And system one is where we use these mental shortcuts, rules of thumb, et cetera, to come to these decisions. The answer is the ball costs 5 cents and the bat costs $1.05. But almost nobody answers that. Their first reaction is, well, okay, we're talking about a dollar difference here, $1.10 total, so 10 cents and a dollar.
Right.
The ball must cost 10 cents, but you think of it, you think, well, that's a 90 cent difference. That's not a $1 difference. I want the math that gives me the bat costing a dollar more than the ball. And it's actually incredible how much time it took me to do the math to get the right answer.
I was doing the math as you were talking, thinking, okay, I know
I could smell it.
And I knew that wasn't the answer, yeah. But I'm trying to think, wait, what is it? And I couldn't come up with it. It's just, yeah, it's sad, isn't it?
Yeah, but well, in everyday life, that answer is good enough. And I think that's one of the reasons why heuristics are important, where they're not to be dismissed. They're basically shortcuts. Now, the key in leveraging cognitive biases is you think of it as it's almost like a neural hack. You're hacking. You know others are taking shortcuts. So how do you hack those shortcuts? And at the same time, we're thinking about ourselves, you know that you're prone to these mental shortcuts, and sometimes you're going to make mistakes based on them. So how do we rethink our own decision-making? Uh-huh. And we're going to talk about how these, we've got a list here, you're going to lob a bunch at me, and I'll talk to them as best as I can. And I'll give business examples. And some of the examples, the more interesting one are the social examples. We'll try to bring it back to business, but we'll end up talking about some kind of larger social issues as well, primarily because I really have the urge to.
What you just said, I thought it brought this home to me. We know that the people we're talking to in a new business situation are taking mental shortcuts. So how do we nudge them without manipulating them? And that makes perfect sense. So are we ready to dive in here?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so we have about 10 of them. We'll see how many we get to. The first is anchoring. So talk to me about the anchoring bias.
Yeah, anchoring effect, anchoring bias, also known as anchoring and adjusting. I think we've talked about this before at least once in the podcast we did on the book itself. Anchor high is one of the rules, one of the 6 rules of pricing creativity. Anchoring is essentially the tendency for the first piece of information on a topic to skew the final outcome or the final decision that somebody makes. Now, you and I did a seminar together, a 2-day seminar, I think it was 2 days, in Atlanta, Georgia. It was about 5 years ago. I think it was somewhere around 2015.
Yeah. Oh, I remember this like it was yesterday.
Yes.
And this was your idea. Let's do this. And I'm thinking, what? And it was so fascinating. Yeah. So remind people what we did here.
We had 70 people attend from fairly geographically far afield. We had people coming from around the world, primarily North America. But in advance of the seminar, I sent everybody a question via email. And the question was, thinking of all of the firms who will be in the room, and nobody knew who else was going to be in the room, but thinking of all the other firms who will be in the room, what's your estimate of the average blended hourly rate? And the control group answer, which implies there were two groups, but everybody got this control question. The control group answer was $171. So on average, the people who just got that question said, oh, I think the average blended hourly rate of the firms in the room will be $171 an hour. But half of those people also got an anchor question beforehand. And the anchor question was this. It was, thinking of the firms that will be in the room, do you think the average blended hourly rate will be higher or lower than $500 an hour? Right? So you get this question, and then the anchor group average answer was $237 instead of $171. It was 38% higher. Now, why is the anchor group, the group that has been anchored with that question about higher or lower than $500, why is on average their answer higher? It's because when I asked the question, they started to think that's a really high number. Everybody answered, no, it's going to be lower. But by asking the question, they start to think of the more expensive, more sophisticated firms that they know. I'm planting the seed, essentially, and their answer skews higher.
Right.
So it's known as anchoring and adjusting. We jump to a conclusion using what Kahneman calls this system one, this cognitively efficient way of thinking. And then we employ the more cognitively expensive, like rational system two that takes more brain power. We employ that kind of reasoning system to reason away or adjust away from the anchor. And what all the science shows is there's kind of this range of like acceptable or rational responses. But we stop moving once we get to the outer edge of what we conceive to be a rational response.
Right. You and I have a fair bit of overlap in our client base. And so I'm constantly running into people that know you and have worked with you or want to work with you and so on. And invariably, what they say after I mention your name is, oh, yeah, I have learned so much by using this anchoring effect. And then they go on and they talk about how you apply it specifically to marketing firms, firms under the marketing umbrella, entrepreneurial creatives, and the impact on pricing. And it has had a staggering effect out there. So it's really interesting to me how basically the anchoring is anchoring your work out there. And then we shared this result, right, with people,
yeah,
just so that they knew that this really happens. It really happened to them. It doesn't just happen to other people.
There are three identified ways where you can undo the anchoring effect. People keep doing studies on this, but nobody knows what they are. I mean, I know what they are, but nobody knows what they are. So even when you know somebody's anchoring high against you, you can't really undo the effect on it. And creative people anchor high all the time. If you go into your client's office to present creative concepts or work of any kind, and you've got the one idea that you really want to sell, but you're worried it's a little bit too out there for the client, what you do is you create this even more radical idea and you put that one forward first.
Right.
Because the job of the anchor is to make the other options look less
unreasonable.
Yeah. Look more reasonable or more desirable. So creative people anchor all the time. It's in pricing, you're anchoring high. It's the first number that people hear should be a high one. And then they make decisions from there. There's all kinds of other kind of science behind this. I'm adapting something from Dan Ariely's book, Predictably Irrational. He says, a price becomes an anchor when the client contemplates buying a service at that particular price. So you just have to get them trying on paying multiples of what their budget was first, and then you can lead them to another option that's just maybe one or two multiples of it. I'll tell you, I know we're going on anchoring. We could do a whole show on anchoring, but a friend of mine and somebody you know as well, you published his book, Cal Harrison, The Consultant with Pink Hair. He wrote an article about a consulting engagement he sold at $300,000. The client's budget was $30,000. So he 10x'd, he got them to choose an option. He presented multiple options. He presented three options. He got them to move from 30,000 to 300,000. And the way he did that, you might think that was the anchor. No, he led with the anchor option. And the anchor option was priced at $30 million.
Right.
So the client says, I have a budget of $30,000. And you go in and say, I have three different ways we can work with you. The first one I'm going to present to you is $30 million. And the client falls out of their chair and they can't even hear what you say next. All they can hear is their heart in their ears. But then they actually contemplate, they try this on, it becomes anchored, it becomes coherent in their mind. And then when you move to the cheap one, here's what we can do for $30,000. It's not nearly as much. It's not nearly as elaborate. Now, if you're interested in the one in the middle, it's only $300,000.
This is a little bit dangerous, okay? Where I'm headed now is thin ice. You can hear the crackling underneath all of this. But the opposite of anchoring is when a firm goes in and they have a real minimum price, and then they sock all kinds of change orders into the project. And rather than aiming high and then pleasing the client at the end by coming in at or slightly below. I know that's really an abuse of the anchoring concept, but I feel like the opposite of anchoring in some senses is trying to get in there low and then charge more, as opposed to handling all of this a little bit more psychologically and transparently at the beginning.
Yeah, I would say you're right. It is slightly thin ice, but I understand what you're saying. And I think the principle applies. You're saying don't go in low and change order people to death. Start really high. The job of the anchor price, if you're presenting options, is not to sell that anchor option. It's to make the other ones seem more desirable, which is a natural segue into the next bias on our list.
Yeah, the decoy effect. And before we get into the second one, some of you are listening to this while you're driving and you're madly trying to write down all the names of the books and the authors and so on. We'll put all those in the show notes so that you can just enjoy and not worry too much about pulling over or running into somebody. And I think this may end up being a two-part podcast where we get through a bunch of them and we pick up the rest later if we need to. So the second one is the decoy effect. Let's talk about the decoy effect.
The decoy effect, some people use it interchangeably with anchoring. It's not the same idea, but there are some similarities. It's essentially a change in preference between two options when a third, like decoy or almost irrelevant option, is presented. And the technical name for what's going on with the third option is an asymmetric dominance, when an option with an asymmetric dominance is added. So the most often cited story of the decoy effect also comes from Dan Ariely, and it's quoted many, many different places. So Ariely is reading something and he sees an ad for subscriptions to The Economist magazine. He thinks, this is really interesting. So there are three options here. I can buy the online subscription for $59. I can buy the print subscription for $125, or I can buy the online and print combined for $125. So the decoy in there is, well, why would anybody choose the print option only? Because if you're interested in the print, you're also going to get the web for free. So the print option is there only as a decoy. Nobody chooses the print option because for the same price, option three, you can get the print and online version. So he decided to do some studies around this in his MIT MBA class. And what he found is when presented with the decoy, those three options, online subscription for $59, print for $125, or print and online for $125, as you would guess, nobody chose print only. 84% chose the print and web version, and 16% chose the online version. Now, as soon as you take the decoy out, the numbers change, or the results change radically. 68% choose the online version. So where it used to be 16% choose the cheap price, it's now over two-thirds choose the cheap price. It goes from 16% to 68%. And the print and web version goes from 84% down to 32%. So by removing that decoy that nobody chose, total sales drop by 44%.
Wouldn't you think it was just a typo if you saw it, though?
It's a pretty elaborate typo. There's three different options laid out in the ad. Now, this has got a lot of traction. It's been quoted many times, and there's been other studies done in support of it. So the idea is, if I give you two options, and let's say you are inclined to choose option A, I can sometimes get you to choose option B by introducing option C, knowing that there's no way you're going to take option C.
Yeah. Not the option as a typo, but the price would be a typo.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because it just seems so illogical. So how would this, in an application to a firm that's listening to this, how would this differ from the anchoring and like three options and so on?
Yeah, and we'll tie it to anchoring. We'll tie it into the next one, this idea of extremeness aversion or extremeness bias. Let me just speak to that, and then we'll come back to this. So extremeness aversion is the idea that people tend towards the extremes in decision-making, and they retreat to the safe middle. So when you're putting forward three options to the client, know that their tendency is to move to the middle option. So you want to architect your choices with the assumption that people will choose the middle one. You want the middle one to be a high margin option to you. And you treat the anchor essentially as a decoy. So when you have three prices and the highest price really technically is only the anchor, it's always a decoy. But it's only an anchor when you lead with the high price, because anchoring is about the first piece of information. So you see how these two concepts go together.
Right.
If you were to put forward three options and you start with the least expensive, then you go to the middle, then you go to the highest one, you are employing the decoy effect and you're taking advantage of extremeness aversion and the likelihood that somebody will go to the middle. But when you start with the high option, the anchor, now you're also employing the anchoring effect and you're increasing the likelihood that people will choose the middle option. And of course, from time to time, they'll choose the expensive anchor option and you celebrate like crazy.
So if you are in a conversation with a prospect, are there some clues that might indicate which of these three or combination of three you might employ to move the discussion, to nudge the discussion in the right direction? Is there something that you're listening for that would say, oh, we need to do maybe the decoy effect, or no, we need to start with a really high one?
No, I think you're employing the decoy effect and the anchoring effect at the same time and simultaneously leveraging extremeness aversion. So you are anchoring high, you're beginning with the high number, and you're putting forward a high number. It's not a full-on decoy in that it would be an irrational decision if somebody chose it.
Right.
Right. So a pure decoy is just like, I'm going to offer something that I know they're not going to take, but it's going to skew the decision ultimately that they make. But I just know that they're not going to take that. So in some ways, it's a decoy, but you want to think of it primarily as an anchor. But you're effectively using the two principles simultaneously.
And I think part of what keeps us on the right track ethically is to design choices that actually somebody somewhere someday might take. And if they do, they're going to get tremendous value from it. It means that they want a very, very thorough approach, and money is not much of an object, and they really want to do this. Very few people will choose it. So that seems like there's a little bit of an ethical chalk line underneath that.
You're trying to limit the hate mail. And I think when we just talk about this principle or these two principles in isolation of other aspects of value-based pricing, I can see how people can get their hackles up. But when you package it up with things that we've talked about previously on this podcast, the idea that you should be just intently focused on creating value for the customer, and the options that you're putting forward are three legitimate options on how you can help create value.
Right.
Then, you know, kind of the subterfuge loses what I think is the gloss of the dark arts, right? But yeah, again, in isolation, when we're talking about these things, it does sound like pure manipulation.
Right. Okay.
And I enjoy that.
Yeah. Can we move on from these first three, or is there anything you wanted to say to tie them together? Are we good?
No, we are absolutely not going to cover all of these in this one. So
okay.
Let's keep going and you decide where we draw the line.
Okay. So let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and we're going to talk about survivorship bias.
You're listening to Two Bobs, conversations on the art of creative entrepreneurship. Your hosts are David C. Baker of Recourses, author, speaker, and advisor to owners of expert firms, and Blair Enns of Win Without Pitching, the sales training and coaching program for creative entrepreneurs. For more information, go to twobobs.com. If you find this podcast helpful, please help us by telling a friend and rating us on iTunes. Thank you. Now back to David and Blair.
Let's talk about the fourth one, survivorship bias.
Yeah, survivorship bias is really kind of related to sampling bias or the law of small numbers. It's essentially where we exclude failures from the sample when we're making a decision. So the best example I can think of in the business world of our audience is when you're advising a small design firm or a designer to specialize, and they push back and they say, well, I was at a talk recently and I saw X, this rock star designer who is this famous designer generalist. I saw him say, do not specialize. You need to build your practice so that you are free to design whatever it is you want to design. That person on the stage, the rock star designer, is subjected to the survivorship bias, where essentially he's saying, look at me. I am proof that you can do this. And I say, no, he's the contradiction that proves the rule. Survivorship bias means he's essentially neglecting every other designer on the planet who has attempted to do what he does and has failed.
Right, right.
The fact that there are only a small number of people who are able to do this. So when somebody says, look at me, I did this, or look at Apple. Well, Apple is the exception, right? If you just look at Apple and you don't look at every other company that tried to do what Apple does or attempted, et cetera, or everybody else who attempted to do what you did or what your sample or example did, if you do not include the failures, then it's not statistically relevant.
Right. So would this also be an example? So the person's in the audience and somebody says, you should specialize. And they raise their hand and says, yeah, but I know this firm that did. And then the bottom fell out of the market. That's why I don't want to do it. Is that another example on the other end of the extreme?
Yeah, that's a great example. That's the law of small numbers. It's just extrapolating these big kind of decisions or what you see as facts or certainty from a very small sample size. And, you know, there's also a recency bias, which is the most recent thing that happens to you, tends to kind of skew your thinking around what the averages are and what the probabilities are.
So how would this apply to a sales setting? How would survivorship bias?
Again, not so much a sales setting, but a positioning setting.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, where you're looking and think, well, so-and-so is doing it, or so-and-so is saying, well, I did it. Well, yeah, you're a sample of one.
Yeah, right. Or that there might be an objection from the prospect that throws something back in your face and you might have to just kind of chuckle and say something sort of somewhat interesting and explain, well, that's sort of an exception. Like, here's really the rule.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's survivorship bias. What about social influence? That's an interesting title.
Social influence?
I need to learn about social influence. Yeah.
Why is it interesting?
Because I don't have any.
Because you're antisocial?
Yeah.
That's known as the David Baker effect, which is the opposite of the bandwagon effect. The bandwagon effect is an example of social influence. It's like, well, if Billy jumped off a bridge, would you do it too? You know, my mom used to say stuff like that to me all the time when I was a kid, because I was so easily influenced by my peers. I was so easily influenced. So she would always accuse me of it. And that's essentially what it is. It's the effect of others on our emotions, our beliefs, and our opinions. So the bandwagon effect is an example. So you think of conformity, socialization, peer pressure, obedience, leadership, persuasion. Those are all kind of functions of social influence, how others seem to have an effect on you. And the way you can leverage this in the sale is when you're putting forward options, you can point to the middle one and say, most of our clients hire us at this level. Or almost all of our clients engage us to do the execution as well as the strategy and ideation. So that's an example of like bringing others into the room to kind of try to generate some FOMO, or this idea that, well, these other people must know something. And you see it in SaaS pricing all the time. SaaS companies are sophisticated pricers, so you'll see three or four options. And the one they want you to buy usually has a little call out that says most popular.
Most popular. Yeah. So you might even say, and I find myself saying this when I'm working with clients where they're objecting to a particular direction that I'm suggesting. And I'll say, listen, we don't have to do that for sure. You know, what I just suggested is not essential at all. We can keep going and you can be the same kind of firm you have been. And then to not be disingenuous, I'll say, and here are the results. You know, you've made a good living, you've got a good culture, but you're hiring me to help you do better. Like, we're not trying to keep you busy as a firm. We're trying to generate a price premium. And I've heard you say the same thing too. So just explaining to them that, listen, we're trying to be a little bit different than the norm, the social influence. We're trying to make you above that, this whole FOMO thing.
Yeah, and social influence might cause that to backfire on you. If you could frame the argument a little bit differently, if you could say, listen, you know, you're down here at this level, but you know, all of the firms that I work with get to this level or aspire to this level. Be a part of the herd. Don't get left behind. Don't miss out on what everybody else is experiencing. That's the way you would want to leverage social influence.
All right. So, Blair, we've covered the more difficult ones, the first five. We have five more that are a little simpler to cover. And the next one is the confirmation bias. This one I hear a lot. So just summarize the intent behind this one.
Man, we could do a whole episode on this, but I think this is the one that's more socially interesting and less practical in terms of business. Confirmation bias is simply the tendency for more information to confirm our existing beliefs instead of to challenge them. So it kind of speaks to how we search for, we interpret, and we invite, and we favor information in a way that supports our beliefs. It's essentially the effect of our desire on our beliefs. We want things to be true, so we look for information to support that it's true. In the business context, I think of the iceberg of ignorance, the idea that somebody who's at the top of an organization is surrounded by sycophants typically, and those people bring that person information that aligns or supports their point of view and doesn't challenge it. And I think we may have talked about this before. I find it happens to me all the time. People that I know well, or sometimes people that I barely know, send me information that supports my beliefs on how new business should be done, the idea that you can and should win without pitching. And every time I get one of these articles or stories, I think, okay, well, where are the five that challenge it? How come people aren't challenging my beliefs?
Right.
And the more you express your belief, the more inclined people are to bring you information that supports your belief.
Ah, I'm thinking of basically circles of influence on Facebook, and their algorithms even encourage this sort of thing, right? And we look at how our political environment has been shaped recently and how this is just so related to confirmation bias.
Yeah, and all these next topics really could go down that rabbit hole of, you know, what's going on socially and politically today and how the AI bots of social media are confirmation bias bots. So the more information of a certain type you look for, the more you're presented, the more your belief gets cemented and cemented, which leads us to the next bias, which is certainty bias, which is the idea that, well, Richard Feynman, who's the greatest physicist of, I guess, the last generation, had this line that in physics, nothing is certain. There are only probabilities. But your argument is more convincing when you put forward something as a certainty or when you communicate your certainty. Like nobody bangs their fist on the table and says, there's a 66% chance that I'm right.
Yeah, right. You can't stand up in front of church and say, I really believe there's a God. You know, it just doesn't have the same ring to it, right?
Yeah, I'm 82% certain that there's a God. But in physics, like if you get into QED, quantum electrodynamics, like when you bounce a photon off a mirror at a 45 degree angle, you can't say with certainty that that photon is going to refract at a 45 degree angle. It's all probabilities. And the math that they use to calculate the probabilities actually includes the possibility that that photon takes every possible path through the entire universe before it gets to that mirror. That's probably going too far down the rabbit hole, but there is an entire branch of science that says there is no certainty in this branch of science. There's only probability. So they put forward things, like most responsible scientists, at least physicists, put forward things as probabilities. Now, I listened to a recording of a cognitive scientist, whom I won't name, talk about like eight certainties in life. And the first one he identified was the universe was created 13.79 billion years ago. I'm thinking, no physicist, he's not a physicist, he's a cognitive scientist, no physicist would ever say that.
Right.
What they would say, if they were rational, is they would say, well, the consensus opinion is that the universe was created 13.79 billion years ago in a big bang, but there's a lot of holes in that opinion. There's a lot of stuff that we don't know. There's a lot of assumptions. There's a lot of errors, etc. That's kind of the responsible answer. You don't stand up there in front of a classroom, a teacher, and say, well, these are the odds. You project the certainty. And we're all guilty of banging our fist on the table and saying, I'm certain. It's a slam dunk. Some studies have been done that show that when somebody says, I'm 99% certain, then there's only a 40% likelihood that they're right.
I think as you were talking about that, I was getting this itch to say this. It's like the more of an expert you are, the more comfortable you should be able to live with uncertainty.
So that's a related bias known as the Dunning-Kruger effect that says amateurs or idiots tend to overstate their certainty, and knowledgeable people or experts tend to understate it. In the beginning, when you know nothing, you say, you know, I don't know anything about it. I'm like completely ignorant. But then you learn a little bit, but not enough to know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. So you learn a little bit, you think, oh, I've got this, I've nailed this. And then you put forward this very forthright, sometimes emotionally charged opinion because you have a little bit of information, but you are vastly overstating your certainty or your opinion based on a little bit of information. Then as you learn more, you start to learn what you don't know. So that's why experts, they understate their opinion or their certainty because they are aware of the complexity of the situation. And there's a corollary here. It's called the illusion of explanatory depth. It's basically if you've got somebody pounding their fist on the table saying this is true and they're emotionally charged, first of all, you should infer that they don't actually know much about the topic. And if you want to moderate their emotional reaction and you want to moderate their beliefs, simply ask them to go deeper into the subject matter and explain it to you. Don't challenge them. Just say, oh, that's interesting. Can you tell me how this works? And as they're forced to give you more detail, they come face to face with the realization that they actually know very little about this, and then they moderate their stance and they moderate their emotions.
I think understanding that makes for such better relationships with your clients because you are saying, you know, it's somewhere in the middle. Like, I do know a lot, but I don't know everything. And I have been wrong multiple times. And this could be one of those times when I'm wrong as well. I'm open to that. But I also want to give service to the fact that I have thought a lot about this and done research. And so my initial response to you is this, recognizing that I want to listen very carefully because I might be wrong here. So there's just a way that an expert has a conversation with a client that makes it more of a, not collaborative, that's too far, but makes it a little bit more human and maybe open to learn on both sides. But you still have to have an opinion that's informed, but you have to be willing to listen as well.
I think that's a great way to summarize that. And I think when you and I, when we're doing these podcasts, we are at our most self-aware. I mean, sometimes we sound so balanced and smart.
When was that? Which particular episode are you thinking of? I need to go listen to it again.
But, you know, we're hotheads too. And we react in the situation and we're subject to biases all the time. And when you stop and think about things, I think if there's an overarching piece of advice that I would just give to wrap all of this up is, you know, when you're thinking about the biases that you are prone to in your life, the simple advice is to stop and to increase the space between the stimulus and the response, to engage system two, to let the emotions kind of diffuse a little bit, to think more, because as you go deeper into the subject matter, if you have an emotional response to something, you probably don't understand it very well. So you're responding instead of going to Twitter or Facebook and then pushing your response out there. Just think more deeply about the situation. Engage in system two. So we started talking about leveraging the biases in others. And I guess we ended with, once again, a little self-help podcast of how you can become a better person.
Yeah, that's right. Well, have we beat this to death?
Yeah, I think we've run out of time.
Yeah, but the other ones were framing effect, sunk cost bias, gambler's bias, if people want to look these up. But what else do you want to say about any of these?
I think I wanted to talk about gambler's bias and what I call the hot hand fallacy. Do we have time? Do you want to do this?
Sure, go for it.
Gambler's bias is, well, let me ask you, if I ask you to flip a coin, what are the odds it'll come up heads?
50%.
Okay, if you flip three coins in a row and they come up heads every time, and I ask you to flip a coin a fourth time, what are the odds that it'll come up heads the fourth time?
Well, statistically, I know it's 50%.
Yeah, statistically, you know it's 50%.
Because I know it starts over. Math does not have a memory.
Right, yeah. But the gambler's bias is, well, the last three ones were heads, so the next one is likely to be tails.
Right.
But as you say, everyone starts over. So it's essentially not fully understanding probability. And I think there's three levels of understanding probability. There's most of us who don't understand it at all. And we see things like streaks and a new manager bounce in sports when the sports team fires a manager, hires a new one. We think, oh, those are actually real things. Mm-hmm. And what we don't understand is it's basically everything reverting to the mean, or some other basic principle of probability. And then there's the second level is when you understand these things and you rationalize just the way you did right now. Well, like I know intellectually that it's 50% because you understand the basics of probability. And then I think there's the third level of probability where somebody like Nassim Nicholas Taleb was a very smart man. But if you look at his Twitter profile, he thinks everything in the world is probability. So I think the third level is where you ascribe way too much of how the universe works to probabilistic stuff.
Oh, man, you just messed up my world. I thought I understood it. And then you throw that at me.
No, I think you're at the right level of understanding probability. My point is, I know some scientists who I think go too far on probability. And they say things like, yeah, well, people don't understand that improbable things happen all of the time. Well, that's actually very true. Improbable things happen all of the time. But they then use that to explain away just unexplainable phenomena.
Okay, so if people want to do some more research on this, let me just list the 10 again so that they can look these up. So anchoring, decoy effect, extremeness, survivorship, social influence, confirmation, certainty, framing effect, sunk cost, and gambler's bias. And this has been fun. I feel like I've learned more than average. You must have been reading, and you're dropping names like they mean nothing to you. This is very impressive. Next time we talk and you're interviewing me, I'm going to have to come up with some much better stuff than I have been in the past.
Well, I did have to prepare for this one, and I still resent you for that.
Okay. Thank you, Blair.
Thanks, David.
Thank you for listening to Two Bobs with David C. Baker and Blair Enns. Subscribe and learn more at twobobs.com. That's the number 2, BOBS.com.